It's Wednesday, July 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a court ruling is made on China's territorial claims in the South China Sea. North Korea cuts communication ties at its United Nations mission.
Brexit means Brexit, and we are going to make a success of it.
A new prime minister is about to take over in Britain. Also ahead, social media's relationship to race and law enforcement. And coffee tourism is brewing in Laos. It's all on today's International Edition. China swiftly rejected an international tribunal's ruling Tuesday that its expansive claim to the South China Sea had no legal basis, saying the ruling was null and void and that Beijing would not accept it. The ruling by the five-member panel at The Hague handed a massive victory to the Philippines, which had filed the case back in 2013, challenging the so-called nine-dash line that China uses to claim virtually the entire South China Sea. Manila opposed it because it infringes upon its own 200-mile exclusion economic zone. Attorney Paul Reichler headed Manila's legal team, and he tells International Edition's Ira Melman the result was better than the Philippines had hoped.
The Philippines believed in the validity of each one of the claims that it made and presented before the tribunal. And the Philippines has always been optimistic about the outcome, although one can never be certain what any court or tribunal will decide until you see the final decision. And I think this vindicates the Philippines' claims and its decision to go forward with the arbitration.
Chinese President Xi Jinping, as you probably expected, repeated Beijing's stance that the South China Sea has been Chinese territory since ancient times and that China's territorial sovereignty and interest in the region wouldn't be influenced under any circumstances by the ruling. Just about saying we don't care what it says. We are just going to go on as if no ruling had been made. How do you react to that?
Well, with all due respect to the Chinese leaders, who are very capable and very wise people, I think we haven't heard the final word on this subject. What China has announced today and what they have been saying over the last several months is not the end of the story. We now have a situation where the legal rights, not only of the Philippines, but also of all of the other South China Sea coastal states have been defined and have been articulated and have been confirmed. It's not just the Philippines that wins from this decision. It's also Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam, and other states with coasts along the South China Sea, which have legitimate claims under the Law of the Sea Convention to 200-mile exclusive economic zones, just like the Philippines. If the nine-dash line is unlawful and invalid, as applied to the Philippines, as the tribunal decided, then it is equally unlawful and invalid as applied to Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam, and other states. So I think China will be confronting a situation not just where it's facing the Philippines across the South China Sea, but it'll be facing all of its neighbors who have a common position that the nine-dash line is unlawful and that their rights, as recognized by the tribunal under the Law of the Sea Convention, out to 200 miles, must be respected. In the end, I think it's inevitable that there will be a negotiated diplomatic solution. It may take a year, it may take 2 years, it may take more. And by definition, if there is a negotiated solution, it means it has to be something acceptable to all sides. And the other states, that is the states other than China that border the South China Sea, will not simply accept the abandonment of their rights, will not simply acquiesce in an illegal nine-dash line claim gives to China 90% of the South China Sea and all of its resources. I think China understands that, and I think China will eventually find a way to reach an accommodation with its neighbors through skilled diplomacy and, above all, The solutions to these conflicts must be peaceful.
Paul Reichler, Philippines lead attorney in the South China Sea ruling. It's time for us now to check out what the online community is saying about U.S. politics and an important endorsement that Hillary Clinton has clinched. International Edition social media guru G. Abby Lee joins me here in the studio. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. That's right. Hillary Clinton finally got that endorsement from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Speaking of guru, I think he looks more like a guru than myself. Shortly after the endorsement, her team posted a photo of them together and captioned it, "Together, let's go win this election." So far, more than 14,000 people liked that tweet. Interestingly, though, one of the most liked comments to that tweet has nothing to do with the election, but it has a lot to do with what has happened in the last few days. A woman named Tatiana tweeted, "At Hillary Clinton, at Bernie Sanders, shame on you both for not mentioning #Dallas. Pathetic." Dallas is where five police officers got killed by a gunman.
Well, what about Bernie Sanders? Did he tweet?
He thanked his supporters, yes. He wrote, "Thank you to the 13 million Americans who voted for me and the hundreds of thousands of volunteers who worked so hard on our campaign." He's on Twitter at Bernie Sanders. He also retweeted one of Donald Trump's tweets, who is very much not happy about the endorsement.
Surprise! Mm-hmm. So what did Mr. Trump tweet?
Oh my gosh. He sent out several tweets about the endorsement, calling Sanders a sellout. Trump tweeted, "I am somewhat surprised that Bernie Sanders was not true to himself and his supporters. They are not happy that he's selling out." He also argued Bernie Sanders endorsing crooked Hillary Clinton. This is kind of funny, actually. It's like Occupy Wall Street endorsing Goldman Sachs. Sanders' team quoted one of Trump's tweets against him and captioned it, "Big talk from the same guy who was too afraid to debate Bernie in California." If you want to read the whole statement from Sanders, you can head over to his Facebook page. It begins with this sentence: "I am writing you today to express my deep pride in this moment, in this movement, the political revolution you and I have created together over the last 15 months. That's all for me today, Jim.
Well, you've created a great wrap-up, G. Thank you so much. And you may tweet your comments to our Twitter stream. That's found at VOA_IE. And you'll find myself and G on Twitter at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending right now in Asia: Indian Prime Minister appeals for peace in Kashmir. Myanmar trafficking downgrade prompts promises of action with limits. U.S. Defense Secretary makes a surprise visit to Afghanistan. Singapore jails four Bangladeshis on terrorism charges. A private watchdog detects high-level activity at North Korea nuclear site. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website, also on our VOA mobile app, and be sure to check out our special South China Sea Ruling Explained page. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. North Korea has told the United States it is cutting its only channel of communication at its UN mission in New York, while also announcing all matters now involving Washington, including the cases of two detained Americans, will be conducted under, quote, wartime law. The move follows last week's U.S. decision to name North Korean leader Kim Jong-un as one of several human rights abusers and subject to sanctions. James Kim, analyst at the Seoul-based Asian Institute for Policy Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the communications cut is a setback in efforts to ease tensions on the peninsula.
That channel was available for informal discussion between the U.S. government and North Korea to coordinate different matters. Because that channel is no longer there, what that means is that any kind of discussion or coordination between the two countries is now going to be more difficult. So yes, it is somewhat serious.
How often is that communications link used?
I believe it's used quite frequently, more often than we realize. For instance, there was a report in Wall Street Journal that Washington made advances to North Korea for possible talks. with the understanding that the North Koreans would be willing to talk about denuclearization if the peace treaty was on the table. Now, that article in Wall Street Journal suggested that the UN channel was the means by which the U.S. made this advance.
James, last week the U.S. identified Kim Jong-un by name for the first time in issuing some fresh sanctions. Pyongyang responded, calling it a declaration of war. Is that just a lot of hyperbole, or is there something behind that statement?
Pyongyang has always considered these kinds of moves as a serious move. The sanctions placed on Kim Jong-un, as you state correctly, is somewhat of an important first step by the United States in pressuring the North Korean regime to stop or cease from engaging in these kinds of violations.
Also Monday, 38 North, the website that monitors North Korea's nuclear activity, said that satellite imagery from last week showed a high level of activity at North Korea's nuclear test site.
If true, that means that there is likely to be another test, which should not surprise us, given that North Korea has continued on this path in developing its nuclear weapon. What might come as somewhat of a surprise is the timing. It comes after the sanctions, as you point out, after the announcement of the deployment of Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System on the peninsula. It also comes at about the same time that China has also been named about its activities in the South China Sea. All of these impact North Korea's calculus and when it decides to engage in another form of provocation, whether that be in some kind of a missile test or a nuclear test.
James Kim, analyst at the Seoul-based ASEAN Institute for Policy Studies. British Prime Minister David Cameron spent his final full day in office Tuesday after announcing Monday that his replacement, 59-year-old Home Secretary Theresa May, is taking over later today. Her last opponent for leader of the ruling Conservative Party, Andrea Leadsom, dropped out of the race on Monday. May called for unity and pledged to make a success of Britain's withdrawal from the European Union following last month's historic referendum.
During this campaign, my case has been based on three things. First, the need for strong, proven leadership to steer us through what will be difficult and uncertain economic and political times. The need, of course, to negotiate the best deal for Britain in leaving the EU and to forge a new role for ourselves in the world. Brexit means Brexit, and we are going to make a success of it. Second, we need to unite our countries. And third, we need a strong, new, positive vision for the future of our country. A vision of a country that works not for the privileged few, but that works for every one of us. Because we're going to give people more control over their lives. And that's how, together, we will build a better Britain.
Theresa May thus will become Britain's second female prime minister after Margaret Thatcher, who served from 1979 until 1990. President Barack Obama has led a remembrance ceremony in the southern city of Dallas, Texas, for five policemen killed last week by a black militant gunman who said he was targeting white officers. Those killings and the fatal shootings of two black men by police in other parts of the country in the past week were the focus of our latest hashtag VOA TV show. Host Michael Lippin joins me here in the studio. Michael?
Hi, Jim. Thank you. Well, the attack on the police and the shootings of the black men in the states of Louisiana and Minnesota have triggered a fierce debate among Americans on social media as they try to make sense of what happened and apportion blame. This debate has been fueled by viral videos of the Louisiana and Minnesota shootings. I asked one of our show's panelists, Washington TV journalist Ebony McMorris of Reach Media, how she thinks people should respond to those repeated images of violence.
What happens is what people watching that need to say, what is the responsibility that I have to now have in my own community or in my personal life? Law enforcement has to say, okay, how did we get here? You know, that brings up the issue of community policing, of profiling, also of policies. I think that we can't just start with the riot. We can't just start with the protest and the shooting. These are systemic issues that have been going on for a long time, so we have to get to the root of it. But we also know that we live in a society where the attention span is just like that.
It's very short.
Because we also just had the shooting in Orlando. And so that's part of the conversation as well. Mental health is a part of the conversation. I think we kind of cherry pick issues and don't really get to the foundation of it to then figure out how we can solve this.
Well, also on the show, I spoke via Skype to a retired U.S. policeman who trains officers in the use of force in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Here's what Robert Todd Christensen had to say about the responsibility of police to address accusations of racism toward blacks.
I'm so glad that Ebony brought that up about reminding us that there is a problem, a systemic problem that has been going on for years, that is finally seeing some attention to get fixed within police agencies. And with that, we are constantly reminded that there is still a lot of work to do. It's not an over-the-night fix. It has to do with training at an academy level, hiring, recruiting the right people, promoting the right people, and then with the mental health wellness of those police officers, making sure that they are on track throughout their entire career, so when we see issues of racism, bigotry, and hatred, that those officers and those administrators can be weeded out.
Well, another guest joined us in our New York studio, Candace McCoy, a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. McCoy said the viral videos have overshadowed the progress that America has made toward ending discrimination by law enforcement.
When you see these videos, the anger, the sadness, the fear, the frustration that social justice does not seem to have moved forward in these last decades gets condensed into the vision of the police officer. When we could be talking about the failure of education systems in poor neighborhoods. We could be talking about health care. We could be talking about gross economic inequality that is getting worse. But the vision of the police officer as the symbol of racial injustice comes across on video. And so what happens then is it's what political scientists call a condensation symbol for larger problems. So it's not just about police.
Well, if you want to hear more of that conversation, you can watch the full show at www.voanews.com/VOA or on my Facebook profile, Michael.Lippin. Jim?
Thank you very much, Michael. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. What started out as a project to provide an alternative for Laos's highland farmers who are discouraged from traditional slash-and-burn agriculture techniques in the absence of their cash crop opium is now riding the wave of increased international visitors to the UNESCO town of Luang Prabang. This heritage town is traditionally known for its Buddhist temples, but now tourism is booming and paving the way for one company to make its mark with locally grown coffee beans. Daniel DeCarteret reports for VOA from Luang Prabang.
The supply of locally produced quality coffee in Luang Prabang can barely keep up with demand, thanks to the boom in tourism at the World Heritage Site. One company, Saffron Coffee believes it has found a win-win solution for highland farmers who are no longer able to grow opium and are being prohibited from farming techniques that the government says are harmful to forested areas.
So one of the big aims that we have is in the Saffron Coffee Company is to piggyback the work that's been done by NGOs and government agencies previously to promote coffee in the northern parts of Laos. One of the difficulties with those programs is that there's no market provided for that coffee, and that's what Saffron's aiming to do.
In the early 2000s, opium growing in northern Laos began to fall dramatically as the government stepped up its eradication efforts, leaving many households without an alternative income. Many farmers in the highlands turned to rice or corn, which involved a cycle of slashing and burning forested areas, something which the government has also outlawed. But for farmers like Boa Thong, whose trees have been producing coffee for close to a decade, the stable market and higher prices is a welcome alternative.
It's easier than growing rice because when coffee trees get higher, you don't have to cut the grass every month like you have to with rice.
Today, Tong's household is one of more than 780 families in the mountains of Luang Prabang province that have taken to growing the beans for saffron. Farmers were initially hesitant to try an unfamiliar crop, which typically takes 3 years to yield its first harvest. Saffron provided 300,000 seedlings to farmers across the region, but a lack of know-how meant much of the experiment failed.
When we gave the plants to the villagers, they just put the plants wherever they wanted them to grow. They didn't put them in the right place, though, so the plants died.
Promoters now work more closely with farmers. And this province produced 12 tons of coffee during the last harvest. As tourists flock, demand from hotels and restaurants across Laos for homegrown produce is offering farmers an agricultural alternative. Once known as an opium-producing member of the Golden Triangle, today, many farmers in this part of Laos are seeking a reputation for quality coffee. Daniel DeCartere for VOA News, Luang Prabang, Laos.
Our international edition program may be found in a variety of places at voanews.com, on Facebook at VOA Now, and on Twitter at VOA_IE. For director Tracy Carter, our engineer Zeynep Abdel-Rahman, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us and have a wonderful day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the recent spate of deadly terrorist attacks that have taken hundreds of lives from Istanbul to Dhaka to Baghdad to the attacks in Saudi Arabia. These acts have shown no respect for human life, whether young or old, male or female, Muslim or non-Muslim. These attacks were intended to spread terror and fear. They occurred at the end of Ramadan, the holiest time of the year for Muslims. Indeed, a Daesh spokesman himself called for targeting during this holy month. So what's obviously evident, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby, is that Daesh certainly has no respect for Muslim life, life in general, or any respect for Islam itself. The United States remains extremely concerned about ISIL's ability to inspire terrorist attacks and is working with its partners to help halt the spread of terror. This requires a multi-pronged approach that includes working with partners from around the world to cut off Daesh's messaging, financing, and recruitment networks. The U.S. and its allies are also expanding their ability to identify, disrupt, arrest, and prosecute suspected foreign terrorist fighters. The United States now has information-sharing agreements with 55 international partners to identify and track the travel of suspected terrorists, and the number of countries contributing foreign terrorist fighter profiles to Interpol has now increased by some 400% over the last 2 years. At least 35 countries have arrested foreign terrorist fighters or aspirants, and 12 countries have successfully prosecuted foreign terrorist fighters. At least 45 countries have enacted laws or amendments to create greater obstacles for foreign terrorist fighters traveling into Iraq and Syria. The U.S. is also focused on discrediting the violent messages that Daesh puts out on a daily basis on social media that they use to inspire and to recruit people. In an effort to defeat ISIL at its core in Iraq and Syria, the counter-ISIL coalition has accelerated the campaign against Daesh in those countries. Over the last 6 months, there has been significant progress retaking territory and diminishing the group's finances and access to additional manpower. The United States will continue the fight against ISIL on all fronts until the terrorist group is defeated.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.